KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Depending on whom you talk to, last year was one of the warmest on record, quite possibly the hottest. There is scientific consensus on global warming and the fact that the climate is changing, but not on the impact. In this morning's opening hour of Forum, we want to discuss the global warming phenomenon and its impact, and we also want to look for actions that can alter the course. Forum is next with your calls and emails after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum. There is broad scientific agreement that the Earth is experiencing significant global warming. Some climate scientists are concerned that global warming is occurring more rapidly than was predicted just a few years ago. Clearly, much additional research is needed on the scientific impact of climate change, but there is lack of agreement over what constitutes dangerous climate change. We have witnessed a reduction in acid rain, and we got rid of chlorofluorocarbons in refrigerators, but the United States still uses energy at half the efficiency of Europe and Japan and relies heavily on fossil fuels. In this morning's opening hour of Forum, we want to discuss recent findings on global warming and what actions ought to be taken by government and by citizens. And let me tell you who is joining us for this hour. First of all, I want to welcome here in studio Dr. Philip Duffy, who is a physicist in the Energy and Environment Directorate at Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory, adjunct associate professor, UC Merced, and director of the University of California's Institute for Research on Climate Change and its Societal Impacts. Welcome, Phil Duffy.
Good morning, Michael. Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you. Also glad to have with us by phone this morning New Yorker writer Elizabeth Colbert, staff writer for The New Yorker, author of the forthcoming book Field Notes from a Catastrophe, Man, Nature, and Climate Change. And she did a much praised series on climate change and global warming for The New Yorker. Welcome, Elizabeth Colbert.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. Brenda Wurzel is also with us, a climate scientist for the Union of Concerned Scientists, and she's joining us from the nation's capital this morning. Welcome.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning, and thank you for being here. And Brenda Wurzel, let me begin with you. I'm actually looking at a statement from the White House. The United States has joined with Australia, China, India, Japan, and South Korea to create a new Asia-Pacific partnership on clean development, energy security, and climate change, dated July 27, 2005. And the press secretary, from whose office this came, says that President Bush is addressing climate change. We have an ambitious and realistic goal. We are making real and accelerated progress. What about that?
I think these are our first steps. I think a lot of the leadership is really happening at the state level. For example, California is certainly showing leadership and trying to have very deep reductions in heat-trapping emissions to the atmosphere by increasing energy efficiency, having the million solar homes, and so on. These type of initiatives are leading the pack. Also, the northeastern states are getting together something called the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, and it's a first by state agreement to try to institute some cap and trade, similar to the success we had with acid rain in trying to reduce our sulfur emissions from power plants.
If I can add something, Michael, you know that
Phil Duffy jumping in.
The state of California is not only leading in terms of having aggressive targets for reducing emissions and an aggressive target for producing renewable energy, but they're also leading by having a really outstanding portfolio of basic research into the science of climate change and into how climate change is going to affect California.
We still need a lot on that score, though, don't we? Brenda?
Yes. Yes, we certainly, for example, at Lawrence Livermore National Lab and at Berkeley National Lab, the national labs in California are doing incredible research on climate and modeling of climate. And also on the solutions side, for example, there's research groups at UC Davis that are national leaders in the hydrogen fuel cell technology, and there are great advances within the solar cell initiative, some of the wind turbine energy, increasing the efficiency of wind turbines and their design, and making sure that they are having less environmental impact.
I guess when you look at the overall picture, though, Germany, the Netherlands, and Denmark are at 20% of wind energy. The United States is still emitting about a quarter of the CO2 that's in the air. There's a big, big way to go here. I mean, China's doing a much better job, aren't they, addressing this problem?
I would say Japan is certainly continued a long, sustained trend. In the 1970s, when the world had a shock with the oil crisis, Japan looked at their lack of oil reserves in their own country and said, wow, we are extremely vulnerable, and they have continued to make energy efficiency as a way that they can sort of pluck the low-hanging fruit and increase their economic growth while reducing their emissions. So right now, for example, Tokyo is instituting things by having smart escalators that automatically turn off when they're not in use. They 21% of their fleet are the hybrid cars, compared to only a much smaller percentage in the United States. And their power plants and their energy efficiency are far exceed what the U.S. is doing right now.
If Japan's a good model for us internationally, Elizabeth Colbert, I guess Burlington, Vermont is maybe the model here.
Yeah, Burlington, Vermont is one of the cities that's really done the most to really look at this issue and decide what can practically be done. And as we said before, really a lot of the action on this issue, since we're not seeing federal action, is happening at the local level. And what Burlington has done is just look at everywhere that energy is used, from, you know, waste disposal and transportation, and a lot of energy goes into just heating and lighting our homes, and really tried bit by bit to bring that down. And it's a laborious process, but it can be done.
What about on the technological level? I mean, we're supposedly moving ahead to curb CO2 emissions. There's certainly a lot of effort to at least do something dramatic about alternative energy and not be reliant upon fossil fuels. I mean, just how optimistic are you on that score?
Well, I mean, when you say a lot is being done to curb fossil fuel use, I guess I would disagree with that. I mean, there are places where things are being done, but if you go back to what our federal stated goal is, and it is simply to reduce what is called the carbon intensity of our economy, which is the CO2 output per unit of gross domestic product. But as our economy grows, there's absolutely no goal, no stated goal, and really no action. Concerted action to actually bring down the absolute level. And that is what, you know, matters in terms of the climate, what actually goes up into the air, not what its relationship is to your economy.
There are grassroots efforts, aren't there? I mean, you're
yes,
right
there
about
are.
That. Yeah.
There are. There absolutely are. And there's a lot of movement. I'm involved in a committee in my own town, and people are very interested and very concerned and actually do want to do something. But I think that the reason that people are so concerned is this is a national problem and an international problem. And the action really is crucial at the local level, but it's also absolutely crucial at the federal level. And the federal level brings us to the possibility of an international agreement that will really meaningfully cap CO2 emissions.
Elizabeth Colbert with us from New York, three-part series of hers in The New Yorker on climate change, which is now a book called Catastrophe, Field Notes from a Catastrophe, Man, Nature, and Climate Change. Phil Duffy is a physicist with the Energy and Environmental Directorate at Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory. You were saying before that things look maybe considerably rosier here in California, Phil. Huh?
Things look rosier in the sense that, you know, I'm very impressed by the actions that the state is taking. I think the state is exhibiting, you know, in this subject is exhibiting a lot of bold leadership. And, you know, I think what's going to happen is that that's going to spread. As California leads, others will follow. And so I think it's all good.
Well, your research has been on social impact of climate change. And here in California, just to focus on, continue to focus statewide for a moment, a lot of concern about water availability and about the snows that are simply not there anymore.
Well, the snow is still there. I mean, we can still go skiing.
Higher up you go, you find snow.
It's going to be harder for our grandkids to go skiing. I mean, just as a bit of background, I mean, I am a physicist. I've been working on climate change problems for about 10 years. In the last several years, I've become convinced that the class of problems that's really important is the so-called societal impacts of climate change, as opposed to the climate change itself. I mean, climate scientists tend to focus on questions like how much is globally average temperature going to change over the next 100 years? And, you know, that's globally average temperature is a useful yardstick which we use to measure climate change, but it doesn't really tell you what you need to know. I mean, if I say that the globally average temperature is going to go up by 2 degrees or 3 degrees or 4 degrees or 5 degrees, what is, you don't know whether to be worried about that or not. You don't know what that means. What we need to know is, what does that mean in terms of societal impacts? What we need to know is there going to be enough water to drink? And what we need to know is, you know, how is agriculture going to be affected? How is human health going to be affected? And that class of problems is called known as the societal impacts of climate change. And I think that's really the area that needs to be, well, one of the areas that really needs to have more emphasis in terms of improving our understanding.
It also needs more federal government funding, I would presume, doesn't it? For
sure.
Research,
yeah. Everything needs more federal government funding, Michael.
Everything with respect to climate change and what we know.
Well, and everything else, too. But, you asked about the water issue. And, you know, and this is one that I really think is a genuine issue. And you know, the issue is that, you know, in California and in most of the West, you know, we have enough water, but only barely. I mean, we really don't have any extra water. And actually one of the problems with water in California is the water arrives, as we all know, in the wintertime, which is when the precipitation is. And yet we use the water, we use much more water in the summer than we do in the winter. So we use it when it's not available. And also, water arrives in the wrong places, because if you look at where the precipitation occurs in California, the very heavy precipitation is in the northwest part of the state, which is very lightly populated. The very heavy precipitation is also over the mountains, which are also lightly populated. You know, the heavy population areas are in, the south and coastal parts of the state, which receive relatively little precipitation. So because of that, you know, we've evolved a very complex system of water storage and conveyance, which basically takes the water from where and when we get it and stores it and moves it to where and when we need it. And the system works, but the problem is that, you know, the system is designed around the fact that we have a lot of snow. And in fact, the system relies on using the Sierra snowpack as a natural reservoir. And what's happening and what's going to happen is that as temperatures warm, the amount of snow on the ground is going to decrease. And it's a problem because right now the way the system works is as the snow melts in the Sierra, that late spring and summer runoff keeps the reservoirs full after it's no longer raining. In fact, if you look at the rivers that drain the west side of the Sierra, in many instances, the maximum river flows occur in the late spring after, in fact, the precipitation has stopped. And so we rely on that snowpack as a natural reservoir to keep the reservoirs full, to keep the man-made reservoirs full after the precipitation has stopped. And so if the snow amount decreases, we're going to be in trouble because we'll have extra water in the winter when we can't store it, and we won't have enough water in the late spring and summer.
I'm curious to go off from that to maybe more ecological questions. And Elizabeth Colbert, we keep reading about glaciers melting, and you write in your New Yorker piece about being up in Greenland and suddenly finding a big puddle in your tent, this sort of thing. I guess a lot of people are questioning at this point, how alarmed ought we to be, and what is the impact going to be, and where are the answers in all this?
Well, in terms of level of alarm, I think that the someone said to me something while I was reporting those pieces that has really stuck with me, and many people have commented on it to me, and that is that if you go out into there are a lot of problems in the world where if you talk to scientists, they're actually less concerned than lay people, and the classic example of that is low-level exposure to radiation in terms of nuclear power plants and things like that. And scientists aren't nearly as concerned as, you can get people really riled up about that. But if you go and you talk to climate scientists, you find they are more concerned. And many of them are really, really alarmed at what they are seeing and what they're seeing in their models and what they're seeing on the ground. And one thing that people really have to keep in mind with global warming, which I think is not as well understood as it should be, is that the problem is always farther along than it seems, because there's a time lag in the system, which has to do with how long it takes to heat up the oceans and to melt ice, which are very, very energy, intense things to do. To melt, a block of ice really takes a lot of energy. So we are now melting that ice and using that energy, but eventually that energy, will go into doing other things. And so we're seeing the impacts now of climate change that was set in motion many decades ago, and our children will feel the climate change that we are setting in motion. And that, and the problem is cumulative as, you know, CO2 concentrations in the air go up. So people really have to realize there's not a single, you know, minute to wait, because this problem is already 40 years down the road further than we are feeling now.
I was talking about action before and what's being done on the international scene, and the Dutch are letting their oceans reclaim their land, and in Norway they're looking for carbon and extracting from power plants, and certainly, as I said, a lot of talk about alternative uses of energy. What I'm struck by, Brenda Wurzel, in terms of things that you suggest, get down to the individual level, get down to the level of everyday citizens. I mean, for example, buying local produce instead of seasonal food, or inflating the tires on a regular basis, you know, obviously using public transportation, but other kinds of things like making sure a water heater has an inexpensive insulating sleeve around it. I mean, there is a lot that just can be done on that individual level.
Right. We don't have to wait for national and state and federal policies to start voting, say, with our pocketbooks and with our daily actions, because right now, as was just brought up a few minutes ago, carbon dioxide lives in the atmosphere anywhere from a short time to it can linger for several centuries. And that means that our children and grandchildren really inherit the decisions that we make today. And so, for example, when you keep your tires properly inflated, it's one of the easiest ways to improve mileage in your car by up to 3%. And if everyone were to do that in the United States, then we would really start reducing our emissions. But you have to have a cumulative effect. We also need the, for example, on the car front, there are off-the-shelf solutions today that can lower the weight of the mass of the car, and you can use aluminum in the body, you can have a unibody, you can have special gears that are six gears, are much more efficient than a four-gear. So if you went from a four-gear to a six-speed transmission, you can gain up to 7% in your mileage gains, and you start adding all of these together so that when you're as a consumer, all the automakers are providing us with many more choices out there instead of just a few high-mileage vehicles. I think we could start really shifting and reducing. One of the largest sectors is transportation emissions from the United States.
I didn't want to make this into a debate necessarily on global warming. We've had that program before on Forum. But I did want to hear from a different voice here, and Dick Linson is that voice. He's professor of meteorology at MIT, and I think it's safe to say, well, first of all, welcome, Dick Linson. Good to have you aboard here.
Hi.
Hi. It's safe to say here that your view is, the temperatures have gone up over the last century, but in terms of what it all means and the impact, you're not necessarily among those who are, shall we say, saying that we need to do very drastic things immediately.
Yeah, I think there are several issues here. A lot of what has been discussed so far are actions to be taken, and that presumes two things: that the problem is serious, and two, that the actions, in fact, are related to the problems perceived. And I think on both counts, the uncertainty is far greater than suggested. I mean, when Elizabeth Colbert wrote her article and summarized what there was gross agreement on, it was things like the temperatures increased on the order of 0.6 degrees over the last century. CO2 has increased. CO2 is a greenhouse gas. But there are technical aspects of this that are important and escape people. First of all, we have, you know, we speak about glaciers and melting and so on, and we really don't understand how glaciers work. We don't understand why they were advancing throughout the Northern Hemisphere for about three centuries and why they suddenly retreated around 1800. And we don't understand why the generalized retreat globally seemed to stabilize around 1970. And so very few people will say that's a dead giveaway. The models don't handle glaciers. This is not a prediction. But it's typical of this issue that the focus keeps changing on the alarm. The half degree represents the response so far to about three quarters of what is called radiative forcing. You know, if you consider what's at issue here, carbon dioxide is important because it's a greenhouse gas, and you can calculate the impact. And the impact gets less with each unit you add. It's like painting a window. The first coat makes it pretty opaque. Every subsequent coat does relatively little. We've seen very little. It's been mentioned that there is a time delay. That time delay is not fixed. It depends on how sensitive the climate is. So, for instance, if man accounted for all the change over the last century, and no one agrees on that, then it would say that we have a relatively insensitive climate and we shouldn't worry. The alternative is to assume the models are right, but some processes canceled the difference. And it's popular these days to say aerosols have canceled the difference, but the aerosol scientists say that we don't even know the sign of the aerosol effect. So it's a kind of adjustable parameter. I think that's one aspect of it. But when you come to the actions that have been spoken of, they tend to make people feel good, but every estimate is that they will not bring us close to the Kyoto requirements. And the Kyoto requirements themselves will do almost nothing about climate change. So if you take the problem seriously and you think there is alarm, then the full radicalness of the solution will transcend anything spoken about on this program so far. And I think the public needs a better awareness of how uncertain we are. And if we are going to assume there's a great danger, how truly radical the changes will be needed. I think most people will conclude that you'd do better to make society more adaptable.
Well, then once again, you're just to reiterate what Philip Duffy said, funding is perhaps the way to find some of these answers. More funding?
You know, I think funding can be a solution sometimes or help a solution, but it can also be part of the problem. I mean, the gentleman from Livermore mentioned he's been working on climate for 10 years. I've been working on it for about 30. One thing that anyone who's working on it knows is that most of the people working on it these days have come into it because of the alarm and the huge increase in funding that occurred under George H.W. Bush. I think the minute the $2 billion a year were tossed into research, a lot of new scientists had a vested interest in the problem.
Dick, I don't know.
Professor Lidson is going to are you going to stay with us for a while? Because we're coming up out of break here.
Okay.
For a bit. I know Phil Duffy wants to respond to you, and I'm sure Brenda Wurzel does. And our callers are on the line here. In fact, let me invite you to join us. You can do that now toll-free wherever you're listening to us or however on the Internet. Radio or Sirius satellite, our toll-free number for your calls is 866-733-6786. Again, that's 866-733-6786. Or email us. Our email address here is forum@kqed.org. Talking with Brenda Wurzel from the Union of Concerned Scientists and Elizabeth Colbert from The New Yorker, Dr. Philip Duffy, a physicist with Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory, and Dick Linson just joined us, professor of meteorology at MIT. We'll have your calls and emails when we return on Forum. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about climate change and global warming this hour, about some of the latest findings and social impact and solutions, action, with emphasis on that. Talking with Brenda Wurzel, who is a climate scientist for the Union of Concerned Scientists, and she's with us this morning from Washington, D.C. Elizabeth Colbert, staff writer for The New Yorker, is with us from Western Massachusetts. She is the author of Field Notes from a Catastrophe, Man, Nature, and Climate Change. And Dr. Phil Duffy is here in studio with us. He's a physicist in the Energy and Environment Directorate at Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory and director of the University of California Institute for Research on Climate Change and its Social Impact. And before we went to the break, we spoke with Dick Lindzen, professor of meteorology at MIT, who laid out a case here, I guess, that maybe there's a lot of wheel spinning. Phil Duffy, I don't know. Your thoughts?
Well, yeah, I'd just like to respond to what Dick said before the break. You know, I don't know about you, Dick, but I'm sure not getting rich doing climate research. I mean, I'm involved in it because I like, you know, I think it's important for scientists to work on problems that matter. And I think climate change certainly is a problem that matters to society. And I think it's important, you know, I think it's a lot of us feel that it's important to use science to help solve genuine problems.
You were also saying about Kyoto, though, that maybe Kyoto would be a way to open up new technologies or to foster that kind of experiment.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I agree with one of the things that Professor Lindzen said, which is that even if Kyoto were fully implemented, it wouldn't solve the global warming problem. And that's true, but I do think that it's beneficial to take action and to start. And I think that it's also true that regulation can spur technological innovation. And, you know, a great example of this is a guy named Art Rosenfeld, who's a very smart physicist, and he's also a member of the California Energy Commission, likes to talk about refrigerators. And he shows that about 25 years ago, you know, the state of California started to regulate the energy efficiency of refrigerators. And what happened actually after that was very interesting. What happened after that, you might think that regulation would tend to drive up the cost of refrigerators, but in fact, exactly the opposite happened. After the state started to regulate refrigerators, in fact, the price of refrigerators went down, even though they actually got larger. So refrigerators, at the same time, got larger, got cheaper, and started to use less energy. And I think what happened is, you know, the implementation of regulation spurred technological innovation. The manufacturers took a new look at refrigerators and realized that they could do things better. And I think that if that sort of thing is likely to happen in other areas as well.
Let me go to Brenda Wurzel on this, again, a climate scientist for Union of Concerned Scientists. I'm looking at a couple of scientists here, Robert Watson, Michael Oppenheimer, and it looks catastrophic, to use the word Elizabeth Culbert uses in her book title. Robert Watson says many parts of the world adversely affected, socioeconomic, water resources, agriculture, forestry, fisheries, human settlements, the whole ecological system. Michael Oppenheimer is talking about melting major ice sheets, drowning coastal communities with our current emissions. We're going to lock in warming over the next couple of decades. How catastrophic, in your judgment, a point are we at?
I think certainly the U.S. taxpayer has definitely gotten return on their investment dollars on the science research and climate, because what we have learned over the last 30 years is we are starting to understand processes much better than before and starting to reduce some of the major processes that we're trying to understand. And we're discovering new things like aerosols that we're trying to whittle away at trying to understand those processes. And in general, there's a real disconnect between the science that has been uncovered in the last several decades and what is out there in the popular culture. And certainly what we know is that through study of past climates, we know what the past Earth has been capable of swinging between. We've gone through ice ages. We've gone through warmer periods. We've had higher sea level than now. And we, as scientists, believe we understand some of those fluctuations and the pace of change. For example, erupting volcanoes. We have ocean processes absorbing or releasing carbon dioxide. We also have other processes of mountain uplift, exposing rock that are weathered, such as the Tibetan Plateau. We have processes that change the planet's orbit, reducing the amount of sunlight hitting certain, say, the northern hemisphere, and so on. We're starting to understand this to the point where the increase of atmospheric carbon dioxide levels are increasing today at a rate that precisely tracks man's automotive and industrial emissions. So we have sort of the fingerprint of man's activities on the current atmospheric concentration. And we know that the pace of that change is faster than we've seen, certainly what's recorded in the ice cores of 650,000 years. It is huge.
I'm going to go, thank you for that. And I want to go to our callers. Been waiting patiently to jump in here, and our first is from Dayton, Ohio. Lee, you're on. Good morning.
Good morning. I have a couple questions there for your panel. One is nuclear power. You know, you hear a lot of debate about nuclear power and how dangerous it would be to go to it instead of fossil fuels. How, if done right, how safe could that be? To me, it's not, I'm not that paranoid about it. And number two, in the climate change, you know, they were talking about the climate change as something that's happened over a million years. We get warm periods and we get cold periods. You know, we go into ice ages and out of ice ages and that. And the one other thing we were talking about, like water problems, you know, with the snow melt and that, we've got oceans full of water. How about desalinization? And those are my questions.
Okay, those are good points, and I thank you. And I'm going to defer here to Phil Duffy, who's with us in studio. I mean, the big problem with nuclear power has always been nuclear waste, but other countries are using it and using it well. And what about desalination?
Desalination is very expensive and actually, ironically, also very energy intensive. It takes a lot of energy. I mean, it can be done. One can remove a salt from seawater, but it takes a lot of energy. So it would be ironic to invoke that on a large scale as a response to global warming because, of course, depending how you get the energy to do that, it could make the problem worse.
What about invoking nuclear energy? I mean, from a physicist's point of view.
Well, look, I'm not an expert on nuclear power, but, you know, we all know in France, for example, they get 80% of their electricity from nuclear power. And you know, the world goes on, and they seem to be doing it in a relatively safe manner, though I do not think that the French, like us, don't have a good long-term solution to the nuclear waste problem.
Have you looked into that at all, Elizabeth Colbert? And what's your take just generally on where we ought to be moving in terms of alternatives to fossil fuels?
Well, I think that the nuclear power issue, I certainly do not claim to be an expert on that. It's a very, very controversial issue, as we see now with, you know, Iran claiming to want nuclear power for peaceful purposes, but is that really the case? Some people will say to you that really the only way, you know, we're going to solve this problem is through a new generation of nuclear power. And some people will tell you we don't have enough uranium to really, you know, solve the problem by using nuclear power without reprocessing it, which is extremely risky. So I honestly don't know. I think it's a question that we will need as a society to grapple with to see what, you know, whether there are risks that we're willing to accept or not. But I think it is probably a question I'm going to have to face.
Well, one of the things, Brenda Gwurzel, that I think you've pointed out and the Union of Concerned Scientists has pointed out, just in terms of overall energy efficiency, again, getting back to the individual level, you know, look into the power company that you're deciding to care for or provide you your power.
Well, energy sector, the percentage of when you flip on the light switch, you can see how much your power company will deliver that's from renewable energy. And California certainly has many of those options. And again, those are some of the low-hanging fruit. For example, in Kansas, some people liken it to the Saudi Arabia of wind. We really have not tapped the wind potential that is offshore in many of our offshore locations as well as within the continent of the United States. And we have a huge amount of solar potential, certainly in the western and the southwestern United States. And with the next generation of power plants, be they nuclear or coal power plants that are hopefully not emitting carbon dioxide with new technologies, these are going to take a while to develop. For example, we do not have the time to wait 20 years for some of these power plants to be built and the money that would be invested in these new next generation of power plants. We have to start taking some of the off-the-shelf solutions that we know about today, roll them in, and roll in every solution we can to have any chance of having some mitigation against the warming and not just be in adaptation mode. I think we can avoid adaptation, but hopefully we can reduce the cost of adaptation if we do some of these mitigation by reducing our heat-trapping emissions.
We also need to regulate more regulation for coal, don't we?
It's a very complicated issue with coal. I think we could really use a lot of research into developing the next generation of coal plants because there certainly is a lot of coal, not only in our country, in China and other countries. And those who go first will win, and those who go last will lose economically. If we develop next generation of energy efficiency plants and so on, we can sell that technology to the other emerging economies.
And let's go to more of your calls. Wanda, good morning.
Good morning. First, a comment. I was listening to the gentleman from MIT and the academic who is so certain of his unsurety. I can see him floating away on a broken-off piece of ice floe as he pontificates about how unsure we are about these things, and meanwhile, the rest of us, you know, on land are very sure of what's going on because we can see the puddle in the tent. Anyway, my question was about an online source or a resource for a homeowner who would like to know all the options available, including everything from the very low-tech popular science that started off this whole thing years ago to the very high-tech, because most of us, we look in the papers, we look in the yellow pages, and all we see is pretty expensive people who are doing good things, I'm sure, but if you don't have a lot of money to spend on a cottage and you want to set it up to be as efficient as possible, is there a resource for that?
Brenda Gwurzel, can you help us here?
Yes, there are many online solutions with the Department of Energy. I think perhaps Phil Duffy could point to some of those sites. And the EPA website, you can find energy-efficient solutions that you as the person can do. There are these carbon greenhouse gas calculators. You calculate your own personal carbon footprint. And we also have some of that information on the www.ucsusa.org website. And what you can do is do things that wrap your home heating cooler, your water heater and so on, inflate your tires. And there's all sorts of personal solutions that you can do. Buy local produce whenever you can. Keep it to buying that kiwi that came from halfway around the world on the weekend or something like that, and trying to shift the balance to doing activities that reduce the energy to produce that product and bring it to your home.
You know, let me thank Wanda for her call and just remind listeners that you can join us now at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or by email, forum@kqed.org. Phil Duffy?
Well, I'd just like to remind people that, you know, you can accomplish a tremendous amount of energy saving just by, you know, turning things off. I personally reduced electricity use in my home last summer by 40% just by getting my kids excited about turning lights off and so on. So that's very simple.
Turning your computer off and turning your TiVo off.
Turn everything off. I mean, that's very simple. There's absolutely no capital investment. And similarly, I've reduced my natural gas usage a lot this winter by just turning the thermostat down, and I have some very nice woolly socks and sweatpants, and it's all low-tech, and it's free.
Here's a listener named Richard. Well, actually, before I get to emails here, I wanted to go back, Professor Lindzen, to you because Wanda had kind of dissed you there. And, you know, you have, because of your position, I guess, which it seems to me is a reasoned and obviously scientific position, you get these accusations thrown at you that you must be a stooge or the fossil fuel corporations, that sort of thing. I mean, in some ways, it's kind of a hard position to take, isn't it?
It is, in some ways, as you say. You get accused of all sorts of things, and you get tired of pointing out it's not true, and you find yourself in situations like on this program where you have, like, the Union of Concerned Scientists is an environmental advocacy group, but it's never stated as such. I think Wanda, you know, I can sort of understand her feelings. I mean, if she thinks there's a real danger and there's a possibility of it, and she doesn't like the idea of uncertainty, I mean, you know, we're not dealing with that. We're dealing with a situation where we've seen much less warming than we expect. We're told it's accelerating, but anyone who looks at the record sees that it's been relatively flat for about 10 years, the global mean temperature. You have to assume there's a certain amount of hysteria, and then it gets confused with the issue of energy efficiency.
I think we've got some disagreement here from Philadelphia.
Well, you know, it was recently announced. I mean, 2005 was the warmest year on record. I forget.
But that was from one data analyst, and the others all got different answers. But if you looked at the picture, you'll see you're talking about 0.05 degrees.
That's 19 of the hottest 20 years on record since 1880 have occurred.
You'll forgive me, but that doesn't tell you about trend. The record is 100 years long, and when you are at a high point, as we were, any of the normal fluctuations that you see on that curve will produce record-breaking years. The fact that we have not seen record-breaking years since 1998
But we have.
Only according to the GIS analysis, not the East Anglia analysis, not the IPCC analysis. I mean, you know, in other words, we're taking advantage of the fact that the public has no sense, it appears, of the importance of quantities. And so you can get people excited over a half of a tenth of a degree because it's plus as opposed to minus.
Well, there's no question the public is excited about, and certainly this public radio audience concerned deeply about global warming. In fact, I think we've got another caller who has some actions in mind.
I have to go and teach a class.
Well, I appreciate your being with us, Dick Lindzen, and thank you.
Rate. Have a good program.
Again, thank you for your time, Professor of Meteorology at MIT. Let me get another caller on here, though, who's talking about action. From Berkeley, Kelly, hi.
Hi, it's Tom Kelly, Michael.
Oh, hi, Tom.
I think at some point ought to do a show just on what you can do locally to address climate change. I'm sure you come up with a lot of great ideas. What I'd like to tell your listeners about is our organization, Kyoto USA. It's a small Berkeley-based volunteer organization that is attempting to get cities and the people who live in them to address climate change. And a couple of reasons for that. One, most of us realize that we don't have any traction with the federal government, and so, even though California is doing a great job, the average citizen doesn't have much influence at the state level. But all of us do have some influence or can influence our local city councils and our city governments. And since...
For what kinds of actions, though, Tom?
Well, let me just point out that most of our greenhouse gases that we produced are produced in cities. Through our transportation, electricity use, heating and cooling buildings, waste, water usage. So, I mean, there's a real opportunity to reduce greenhouse gases there. And the beauty of this is that once a city gets involved in it, they also realize that they're saving money. I mean, when a city looks at its energy consumption and starts to do things like changing its street lights, LEDs, switching their fleets over to hybrids, increasing the amount of waste that's diverted from landfills, planting trees. I mean, there's a whole host of things that cities can do. In fact, in California now, a city can join this community choice aggregation process, which allows them to purchase and distribute electricity within the city, and that gives them control over where that electricity comes from. So, in a best-case scenario, that electricity will be coming from renewable sources instead of from natural gas or other fossil fuel sources. So the thing that we're trying to do is to energize people, to get them to realize that they can do something beyond switching their light bulbs, that they can actually do something on a little bit larger scale. And I just like to let your listeners know that the 14 cities in Alameda County have all agreed to look at a greenhouse gas reduction plan. It's going to take citizen participation in that effort to encourage and urge those city governments to not only commit to this but to follow through on it. It's something that's been done in Sonoma County. And it's something that all of us can do, and we can do right now.
Tom, thank you for that. Appreciate your call here, and I'm going to go right to another caller. Peter, morning.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, I get frustrated whenever I hear people talking about alternate energy and conservation, when the whole time we have the ability to put a solar roof on every home, an electric car to charge up, maybe two electric cars, one to use and one to charge for overnight. But I believe it's the government reluctance to implement these kind of things because they don't know how to wean themselves off the tremendous tax revenue. A gallon of gasoline, state and local, is over 50 cents a gallon, I'm sure, and the tax and license for a new car is $2,000. They need to take away the restrictions and provide some incentives for our auto manufacturers, GM and Ford, produce a cheap, affordable electric car. That way we could all take a bite out of this. But first they got to figure out a way to wean themselves off the tremendous tax revenue and things.
All right, Peter, I thank you for the call, and I am going to go to our emails now, a number of them. Actually, a question for you, Elizabeth Colbert, from a listener named Rick, who says, I was curious as to whether Elizabeth could comment on the New Yorker article a few years ago that discussed evidence found in the Greenland ice pack that showed a rapid ice change that took place.
Yes, I wrote that article.
Yes, I know you
did. I'd be happy to comment on it. It was really about what we were talking about before, about evidence from past climates, and I went up to an ice coring operation that was run by some European scientists on the very, very top of the Greenland ice sheet, and they had dug a core down to the very bottom, which is 2 miles down, and had found, and other ice cores had also found, they were just confirming, these really dramatic climate flips, really. And I should point out, in the past, it had taken place in the past, they have nothing to do with human intervention, but I should point out that, you know, that's something that people are very worried, that the climate system is not necessarily a linear system, that it can be a system that actually flips between modes. And a quote that was given to me recently by someone, and I think it's attributed to a guy named Richard Alley, is, you know, you can tip the climate, it's like a rowboat, and you can tip it and it will just sort of slide back, and you can tip it and it can slide back, and then you can tip it and it can go to the other stable state, which is upside down. So people are very worried that you could reach some point where the whole climate system would tip into another mode, which we don't understand, and we as a species have never been around to experience.
Phil Duffy, yeah. A question from another listener. Can you explain why, he's got a whole chart here, but he wants to know about numerous historical cycles of glaciation and significant warming on Earth before the use of oil, coal, or CO2 emissions.
Well, that, you know, this issue was very often brought up, which is, you know, we all know, and geologists particularly know, that climate changes naturally on all sorts of timescales. So how do we know, how can we be sure that the recent climate change is not part of some natural cycle? And in fact, there's, I think, a lot of evidence that's pretty convincing that a lot of the recent climate change, by recent, I mean the last 50 years, is in fact probably not natural. I think actually one of the reasons why it's convincing is that there are several lines of evidence that all point to the same conclusion. One line of evidence is that if you look at geological data for the last 1,000 years, Dick Lindzen mentioned that it's warmed 0.6°C or about 1°F over the last century. You know, on one level, that's not a lot of warming. I mean, it certainly doesn't have disastrous societal impact. It's barely detectable. It's barely noticeable. On the other hand, if you look at the geological data for the last 1,000 years, 1°F in 100 years is indeed very, very unusual, and it seems to be much more than the system warmed in any of the last 100 years over the last millennium.
Of course, Professor Lindzen thinks that thermometer readings ought not to breed a great deal of confidence or utter confidence by any means. I think that's his position. Yeah.
I think the evidence that there is warming is pretty indisputable. I mean, there's evidence from thermometers, the satellite reconstructions.
Look at the number of scientists that have signed off on that. I mean,
the satellite reconstructions are now widely agreed to be broadly consistent with the thermometer measurements, and there is all sorts of other evidence. I mean, you know, there's clearly warming in the polar regions. The ice is melting. The glaciers are retreating. I mean, I think it's indisputable that the system is warming.
And Brenda, you wanted to add something here?
Yeah, I think what we overlook is we are blessed with a planet that is covered by a huge ocean. And the world's oceans have absorbed about 20 times as much heat as the atmosphere over the past half century. And what we see is when we run climate models and look at the North Atlantic, the Pacific, and the different ocean temperatures down 700 meters or several thousand feet, what we see is in the upper layers, the amount of warming that we see cannot be explained by natural processes. But when you add into those models the carbon dioxide levels, the other heat-trapping gases, the solar variation that has changed minimally over this time period, it's a very short time period, and all the other factors that influence climate, whether or not there's a volcanic eruption like in Mount Pinatubo and so on, we see that that is a human fingerprint, because that amount of warming can only be explained when we add the human contributions. It's not as if our emissions of heat-trapping gases are happening in a vacuum. We have a natural world with the natural cycles. It's just we've really tipped the balance, and we've tilted those cycles that are happening naturally.
You know,
we've added to the heat.
You mentioned fingerprints, and my colleague at Livermore, Ben Sander, and others have done work which shows, in fact, that greenhouse warming does have unique signatures. And one of the actually unique signatures of greenhouse warming is that while the lower atmosphere gets warmer, the upper atmosphere gets colder. And that's not true of other causes of warming. For example, solar variability causes the whole atmosphere to get warmer. And if you look at the observations over the last 50 years, the upper atmosphere, the stratosphere, has indeed gotten colder. And that's, I think, can only be explained by greenhouse warming.
We've got one last question here as we come up on the break with seconds to go here. And maybe you might want to handle it quickly for us, Brendek Wurzel. Looks like somebody is dying to know the answer to this. This is Dana, who says, whenever global warming, which should be called global heat retention, is discussed, I always hear the same considerations. Albedo, melting ice, absorbing more sunlight than ice, thawing tundra, releasing more greenhouse gases, rising sea levels, etc. One thing I never hear is this. When ice melts, it absorbs heat that otherwise would go toward increasing temperature. Is it therefore reasonable to assume that when the ice is gone, all the offending sun rays would then go to driving up the temperature so that the real warming would come after the ice is gone? In other words, does the ice create a temperature buffer, and can it affect its effect be quantified?
We see that amplification effect in the polar regions, that when you most of the energy of the sun coming down hitting a white ice sheet or sea ice reflects most of that energy back. Once you melt that back and you expose a warm a dark ocean or a dark land surface, then much more of that energy becomes absorbed and the heating accelerates. So that's why the polar regions, especially the Arctic, are warming much faster than the lower mid-latitudes and tropical latitudes.
Thank you for that. Now I think Dana can sleep at night. I don't know how the rest of you are going to be in terms of restlessness with your sleep, because the global warming picture, at least for most of our guests, is not a pretty one. But certainly grassroots and a lot of positive things being done and concern about alternative fuels, and we've heard a lot of good action and proposals of what needs to be done in terms of government and citizenship today. And I want to thank our guests, Phil Duffy from Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory, Elizabeth Colbert from The New Yorker, Brendek Wurzel from the Union of Concerned Scientists, and we also spoke with Dick Lindzen, professor of meteorology at MIT. Thanks to our producers, Robin Giannatasio-Mal, Hermione G., and Kevin Guillory, to our interns, Rebecca Arnold, Jody Avergan, Sarah Dvorkin, Tamara Helfer, and Erica Holt. Also, many thanks to Tina Lauerberg. And our thanks to Paul Hancour, our engineer, and for all of us at KQED. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.